Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers.
You got to turn it on.
Forward. It's got a light.
Does the light on?
Green.
There you go.
Can you hear me?
Green helps.
This is our, about halfway through our fifth decade, I guess, bringing philosophy to the masses. We've been in this place for around 10 years, and this is our last meeting here. You may have seen the sign when you came in, they're closing. And so our last meeting of the year will be at the El Phoenix on Forest Lane, just this side of Webb Chapel, southeast corner. There's a strip shopping center, and it's sort of right in the middle of it there. So we're going to give that a try for the meeting on the 8th of May.
That's my 14th of May. Hmm? 14th of May.
14th of May, I'm told.
I believe that's what it is.
Second
Tuesday.
Okay. Okay, all right, 14th of May. My problem. So we hope to see a lot of you there. It's the same venue, I think, and it seems to be a nice place. I've been there a time or two. We'll see how it works. Like I say, we've been here for a long time. They've been nice to us. They've treated us well. Please don't walk the check. Tip your servers. If we have to pay for it, we will, but we really can't afford to do that very often. So tonight's lecture will be about 45 minutes or so. Yeah. We'll have some time for Q&A afterwards. Please, if you're going to ask a question, try to put your thoughts in the form of a question as soon as you can. We don't want another 45-minute lecture if we can help it here. Our speaker, Father Joshua Whitfield, is a Roman Catholic priest currently serving as the pastoral administrator of St. Rita Catholic Community in Dallas, in Wood and the Tollway, sort of. Unlike most Catholic priests, Father Whitfield is married with children. He was a former Episcopal priest, and he trained for ministry in England. After his conversion to Catholicism, he's ordained a Catholic priest through the pastoral provision of Pope John Paul II in 2012. He and his wife, Ali, live in North Dallas with their four children. Originally he's from Glen Rose, Texas, the son of a football coach and a physics teacher. He's an alum of Texas Tech, University of Leeds, and Duke University. He's author of Pilgrim Holiness, Martyrdom as Descriptive Witness, and The Crisis of Bad Preaching, Redeeming the Heart and Way of the Catholic Preacher, which is due out this month,
Friday,
from Ave Maria Press. He's also a regular contributor to the Dallas Morning News, which is how I came to know him. He'll be speaking tonight on Mystic Voices, Religious Beauty, and the City. Please join me in welcoming Father Whitfield.
Do I need to do anything? There?
No, you're good.
Oh, great. Thank you. I came with not PowerPoint, but with handouts for those of you who are visual. So I can just send those around. They might. Your brother wants one. Your new El Phoenix is my El Phoenix. That's the one I go to. Right next to my house. It's a good one. I don't know. I think they've got a room like this, so you should be good. Can everybody hear me? I'm sort of a low talker. It's better that way. Little butt. Can you go up maybe a little bit? And it's good to be here with y'all. Like Skip said, I'm at St. Rita Catholic Church in North Dallas, which is just down 635 a ways by Jesuit and the Galleria, and I've been there about 10 years now. I came out of the Episcopal Church and was hired at St. Rita to run all their education programs, and I've just accumulated work. And so by now I'm running the place, which is a nonstop job. But anyway, so to dive into my 45 minute talk, that probably will be worth your time. The talk I gave it, I can't remember what I gave it to Skip, but the talk I was working, the title I was working with is called Mystic Voices of Parish and City. And when I say parish, for those of you that might not be familiar with the nomenclature, parish is the church, the church building, the community, St. Rita Catholic community, but it's also a geographic space, right? And in fact, it's principally a geographic space. So the parish of St. Rita is a huge square mileage area. It stretches from Royal to up past 635 to Coit. So technically speaking, I am responsible for all the human souls within that geographic area, right? And so we technically are in the parish, I think, of Thomas Aquinas, right? And so not only is it a church, but it's actually a geographic space, which is actually a genius way to organize Christians, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. So the task I've given myself this evening is as I said, in the title of my talk, Mystic Voices of Parish and City. And so what I want to explore in only obviously an initial sort of way is the place and the purpose of music in the parish, in the city. So I want to explore music in the parish when that parish is located in a city. Liturgical music, as well as music which belongs to what we call the fine arts. And so the questions I have about music in the parish are these. What's the point of music in a parish church, whether it's Catholic or some other denomination? And does music in such a community contribute to the city, to the community in which it belongs? And can we understand music in the parish, in the city, theologically and or ethically? And so what I want to ask basically is what is different about music performed in a church, in a parish, and what public or civic purpose does such music serve, if any? It's probably a question you have never, ever asked yourself. The immediate answers to these questions, of course, are traditionally clear. If anybody's studied aesthetics, which I'm sure somebody has, the point of liturgical music is, of course, liturgy itself. Liturgy means worship, you know. Liturgos, the work of the people. The purpose of liturgy is simply the praise of God, the fruit. So Augustine taught being justice. You're giving God what is his due. But of course, music is by no means required to worship him. And behind this are cosmic Pythagorean and Neoplatonic notions of harmony, and also of the civic good of Apollonian music and art, which is found in books 2 and 4 of Plato's Republic. You know, words and modes and rhythms must, as he said, suit a life of courage and discipline. And they must penetrate, Plato said, the mind and impart grace and beauty. That's the role of music in the Republic. And behind this as well is Aristotle's idea, which builds on Plato, that music serves purposes, the purpose not only of amusement, but more importantly of education and quote-unquote intellectual pleasure, right, et cetera, that is what music does. Traditionally, the fine arts are, of course, ends in themselves, which is why we call them fine, that is ends, toward the end. But we should as well see them as Terry Eagleton, the great literary critic, sees them as, especially in modernity, as a rival enlightenment project with its own aesthetic agenda, to mythologize reason and replace religion, which, as Eagleton says, is a project that clearly failed. And similar also here, but different, is Kierkegaard's criticism of the aesthetic, which don't have time to get into, all of which suggests, as an aside, that fine arts can only safely reside in the church. But that's not an argument I want to make today. So I don't want to travel these well-traversed avenues for which you could very easily find a better Virgil than me. Rather, what I want to do in asking these questions of music in the parish, and I'm speaking very, very simply here, I want to reflect upon the moment of music, right? The phenomenal moment of music, when music is actually happening in front of you and to you. And to ask very simply, what's going on at that moment? That is, I want to meditate upon the moment of musical performance, not in a superficial way, but deeply, more deeply than we're used to. And by such reflection, I want to argue that it's a moment that is, in a very real way, sacramental, at least how we Christians understand sacramental, and so therefore essential to the mission and work of the church, and therefore the mission of the parish, the Christian community, as she sings her songs in the midst of the urban. Now to begin this admittedly very eclectic reflection, because that's me, I want to begin in the 4th century with a fellow by the name of Gregory Nazianzus, if you've ever heard of him, Gregory the Theologian, as he's sometimes called. And from there, I want to follow the phenomenological thought of Robert Wood and learn as much as we can from his extensive philosophical work in aesthetics. And from there, I want to reimagine the moment of music in light of a theological paradigm called the munus triplex of Christ, which I'll explain later, seeing the work of Christ in terms of prophet, priest, and king. And then from that reflection, I want to argue for the phenomenological and theological good of the moment of music, a moment not merely ethical, but as I said, also sacramental, a moment that's not always immediately or instrumentally valuable for the common good or the public good of the city, but essential nonetheless. That is, for those of us with Christian, or I would even say those of us with simply human commitments. So, moving on. For me, it's the most poignant and provocative and moving texts of all of patristic literature, early Christian literature. I challenge a person to read it and not be moved, and maybe even to tears. It's a sermon. It's called Oration 14, titled On Love for the Poor by St. Gregory of Nazianzus. It was written and preached sometime either in the late 360s or the early 370s, although the original setting of the text of the sermon is subject to debate. Some argue that its relation, some argue that it's a sermon helping the efforts to build the basilias or the tokotrophion, the poor houses of Basil the Great. But others argue that since this sermon addresses leprosy more than famine, the context is different, but that's not important for what we're talking about. It's a text, along with the sermons of Basil the Great and Gregory of Nyssa, the three of those, they're called the Cappadocians, and St. John Chrysostom, the Golden Mouthed, as he's called. It's a sermon which belongs to that sort of genre, which belongs to a revolution in social imagination in the 4th century, ushering into collective consciousness the poor as subjects in and of themselves of dignity and value, and therefore worthwhile objects of material charity. Earlier Greek philanthropy, so people like Peter Brown from Princeton have argued, was utterly civic. Philanthropy before Jewish and Christian thought came on the scene was civic. That is, the recipients of charity were either citizens or belonged to some other recognizable civic category. Whereas in Christian and Jewish philanthropy, the poor were seen and served qua poor, regardless of their civic status. This latter Jewish and Christian way of seeing the poor, rooted deep in Torah and in the New Testament, gave to the new nominally Christian empire a new social ethics, or rather an imagination and motive to see and serve the poor, regardless of whether they were citizens or strangers, because they were seeing the poor, as Jesus himself preached now, as subjects of something called the kingdom of God. This, of course, is a moral revolution we think little of today, and I think mistakenly assumed to be natural and self-evident. But of course it is not. Whatever the broader and particular context and material aim of Gregory's sermon, rhetorically, the goal of his preaching was simple. He wanted to reveal the humanity of the poor, the leprous, and the starving. Right? That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to reveal the humanity of the poor, the leprous, and the starving. And he wanted to uncover, the way he saw it, their sacredness. Right? That is, his purpose was to illumine both their nature and their destiny, and thereby inspire works of Christian charity in a time of scarcity and fear. And I should say that these guys were preaching in a time of epochal famine in the 360s in Asia. So moving on to the sermon itself, and this is where some of these quotes from the top of the page will come into play. So emotively describing worn and bloated and deformed bodies, quote, barely recognizable for who they once were, Gregory of Nazianzus forced his congregation to acknowledge these pitiful persons whom he called, and this is my favorite line from the entire sermon, he forced his congregation to think and to recognize these poor, leprous, famine-stricken people as, quote, our brothers in God, whether you like it or not. Right? That's a line from his sermon. And he says, these were persons who, quote, whose share in nature is the same as ours, and formed of the same clay. He formed them also, and more importantly, he said, to recognize that the poor, quote, have the same portion as the image of God, as just as we do, whose inner nature has put on the same Christ, and who have been entrusted with the same guarantee of the Spirit as we, who have been given to share with us the same laws, prophecies, testaments, liturgies, sacraments, hopes, for whom Christ died, just as he did for us, who are fellow heirs in the life of heaven, even if they have met with so much misfortune here on earth. And he goes on further. He talks even more than just saying, look, these people have our same human nature. He identifies the poor, these people that they see going in and out of church. He identifies them in a unique way with Jesus Christ himself. And he exhorts his hearers at the very end of his sermon by saying, let us visit Christ, let us heal Christ, let us feed Christ, let us clothe Christ, let us welcome Christ, let us honor Christ. Almost more than any other church father in my humble read of them, Gregory of Nazianzus identifies the poor with Jesus Christ himself most strongly. And it's the theology, that's the theology which is at the heart of this revolution in social imagination which Peter Brown describes and others. Susan Holman is another person. And it's theology... It's theology which motivates this very charged rhetoric and these very, very emotive descriptions of the poor and the leprous, grotesque descriptions of the leprous and the poor within the context of his sermon. It's a theology of incarnation, which is really the only sort of sacred philosophy which would make one ever dare to revere deformed and putrid flesh, seeing in that flesh actually God. So Gregory identified the poor emotively and theologically, and this played in that larger revolution in social imagination, the benefits of which we all still enjoy today in the better humanisms of Western civilization. We think giving a shit about Down syndrome children is naturally evident, but it is not. But at the bottom of this revolution, at the bottom of Gregory's rhetorical and theological project, I suggest, and this is getting back to my main point, at the core of his rhetorical and theological project, it is a phenomenal moment that is sometimes musical and always sacramental, again, as Christians understand it. It's the moment of music in which sacred narrative begins to sanctify and begins to sacralize things, again, as we Christians understand it. That is, it's a moment of light, illumination, as the early tradition would have called it, a moment of truth, seeing truth. But to illustrate my claim specifically, and this gets to the second quote in the top of the handout. In the middle of Gregory's sermon, after emotively depicting the sufferings of the leprous and the poor in a very grotesque way, he puts before his congregation the image of the poor standing outside a church. The poor outside and Christian worshippers inside. And then as point and counterpoint, he describes them together as part of one single act of worship, one single liturgy. And so that's the second quote, I think, from on the handout. He says, who is not overcome as their plaintive cries rise in a symphony of lament? What ear can bear the sound? What eye can take the sight? In the hot sun and the dust, they writhe at men's feet. And sometimes, too, they are tormented by biting cold and rain and blasts of wind, and narrowly escape being trampled on only because we find it repugnant to come into contact with them. Their mournful pleas stand in jarring contrast to the sacred chanting within, and their piteous lament forms a counterpoint to the mystic voices. And he goes on to explain his purpose in describing the poor and describing them, in a sense, liturgically as participating in worship. He says, this is the second or third quote, he says, why lay out the full measure of their tragedy to those in the midst of celebration? That is why I say make such grotesque descriptions in the middle of a nice sermon when you're just trying to go to church. Perhaps I might raise a dirge even among yourselves if I were to evoke in tragic detail all their sorrows. Then their suffering will overwhelm your festal spirit. I speak this way because I am not yet able to persuade you that sometimes anguish is of more value than pleasure, sadness than celebration, meritorious tears than unseemly laughter. Preachers don't preach like this anymore, which is part of the damn problem. So that's an aside. What's going on here? This is a Christian sermon, delivered at least initially orally within the context of a liturgy. But for us, of course, it's a silent text to be read. And in this particular passage, the preacher refers both to beggars and worshipers, both of whom were known in antiquity to sing. Beggars, some of whom were known to form troops that would sing and perform for their alms, and worshipers, most of whom were known to sing to their god. But Gregory places the singing imaginary beggars and worshipers side by side so that he might, quote unquote, raise a dirge among the latter, that is the worshipers, in order to persuade his congregation to undertake actual works of charity performed for actual beggars. Now there are two moments going on here, the performance of the sermon, but also the moment the sermon depicts, the musical moment, so to speak, in which the singing of beggars and worshippers form a single act of worship, which is the moment of the identification between the beggar and Christ, and it renders beggars objects of love for the worshipper, and therefore objects of material charity. And so this is the sacramental moment in which poor, putrid, and leprous flesh has become venerable, and even sacred flesh, flesh to be cherished and served. But how have these beggars come to be identified with Christ? This is, as I suggest, or I've hinted only, at first a phenomenological question, and then an aesthetic and a theological one. And this is why reading Robert Wood is so enlightening and helps us focus on the musical moment itself, the moment of art, a moment which is sacramental and transformative, and so to him we turn. So Robert Wood, you should read him, he's good, he's a very smart guy, professor of philosophy at the University of Dallas. He's helpful here because of, obviously, his very extensive work in aesthetics, particularly his phenomenological description of the aesthetic experience. Since art and preaching, which is what we're talking about, are always clearly things that are experienced, a phenomenological account of such an experience can only be helpful, which is why I turn to Robert Wood as we meditate on this thing that I'm calling the moment of music. And so Wood, Bob Wood's, in his book, Placing Aesthetics, very good book, he sets out to describe artistic experience within what he calls the overarching field of experience, in which he argues that there is always a threefold intentionality about such an experience. And of course, intentionality, as you know, relates to how we, it's a term which describes how we consciously relate to objects. And Wood is arguing, to put it very, very, very simply, that we always experience artistic phenomenon in three connected ways. Sensing, and this is in the handout, sensing, interpreting, and what he calls presence to being. Sensing, of course, is just what you think it is. The senses as they receive the sensuous and the sonorous, light, color, touch, sound, smell, and so on. However, our senses, Wood points out the obvious here, our senses are always automatically selective and interpretive, always. For example, when we look out the window, we don't see green, brown, and blue, and billions of dust particles and photons and such. Rather, we simply see trees and sky, right? Sensing and interpreting work together simultaneously. But this opens up to us what Wood called presence to being. He didn't really use the word sublime, I don't think. It opens up the experience of presence to being. As he says, the sensa anchor our awareness in the constantly flowing now, which sounds just like a phenomenologist. And this is an experience which becomes automatically an apprehension of the whole, or of the total, or of the absolute, or of being, however you want to call it. And this experience of being is always, as he said, an empty experience, an experience of being without meaning. That is, you can't put a name on it just yet. And this is the experience of what he calls the bipolarity of human existence, which is an idea he takes from Heidegger, which describes our experience of being at once rooted in the earth and now, yet also open to the whole. I don't know about you, but I understand that. I get that, right? And I think a human person, when they turn the screens off, can stop for 5 minutes and understand that too. And so it's this sense of the emptiness of being which calls forth what Wood calls the desire of the heart, a central feature, if not the central feature, of Wood's philosophical work as a whole. The heart is that central transcultural metaphor all over the globe. It's probably the biggest transcultural metaphor we have, which names our experience of what he calls presence to being, of that which is greater, you know, the whole, the total. And it's art, this is where he starts talking about art, it's art which articulates the desire of the heart, that which sensuously expresses the emptiness of being in space and time. In language and in the various arts and in religion, right? That basically is when the aesthetic steps in, right? Or the forms step in. To put it simply, art supplies the emptiness of being with meaning. Art supplies the emptiness of being with meaning. And Bob Wood reads this experience again and again throughout the history of philosophy. In Diotimus Eros, for example, Wood sees the heart's desire for the whole Eros, which directs the intellect in its apprehension of the form and the total. But art, which expresses the desire of the heart for the whole or the total, which in a sense gives name to being, articulating form, art is not, he's clear, an escape from earthen material, right? Rather, art, in expressing a form of being, he says, deepens the life world of the experiencer of art, right? Art, so to speak, your experience of art doubles back upon the person experiencing it, bringing about in us a different way of experiencing the rest of the phenomenal world. Reflection is used to use the word. And that is art, to quote Wood directly. He says, art, in reference to the whole stemming from an organic base, does not bring about flight into the beyond, but a renewed attentiveness set on the earth of sensuous presence that creates a world of inhabitants. This is what language, the arts, and religions do. They express the desire of the heart, and they in turn they reshape the Lebenswelt, right? They reshape the world. To put it another way, art changes us, and it changes the way we see and experience the world. And this happens over and over and over again in different times and in different places, right? This is the beginning of cultures and the colorful diversity of the world, a diversity which still always bears some sort of mysterious unity. Beauty, right? It's here I think of what Simone Weil wrote once when she said that the soul's natural inclination to love beauty is the trap God sets to catch it. Now, in simple terms, what on earth does that mean? It means this. Each one of us experiences the world as sensing, interpreting animals, each with a nagging, unfulfilled sense of a greater meaning which we cannot name. Yet language, the arts, and religion help us fill that empty space of meaninglessness with meaning. And that meaning, in turn, creates a culture in which our everyday experience begins to make sense. Say, for example, how it is possible to understand one's individual life and even the life of the whole world within the life, death, and resurrection of the parousia of Jesus Christ, which is basically what Christians just did in Holy Week, imagining not just the death and resurrection of Christ, but the death and resurrection of the cosmos. If you've ever studied the liturgy of the Easter Vigil, for example, it's saying as much about the cosmos as it is about Jesus. So to return to Gregory of Nazianzus' sermon, in which he identifies the poor with Christ, and in which he links the singing of beggars and worshippers. What's going on there? When the worshipper sings his or her hymns to the Trinitarian God, that empty metaphysical space is filled with the gospel, with the notion that God assumed flesh and that as the Son, he sits now at the right hand of the Father, still in the flesh. We who share in that flesh, in faith and the sacraments, share also in the perfect communion of God, the perfect harmony of the three persons of the Trinity. And we also understand that flesh to refer to the whole of humanity, right? The flesh of Christ, risen and ascended, is identified with the whole of humanity, because we sing of Christ in terms of, as Paul did, as a second Adam, right? Which in turn makes us read others in terms of that flesh and that same Trinitarian communion. Singing to Christ, therefore, enables us to see Christ in the other, and also simultaneously enables us to be Christ to the other, the worshiping Christ serving the beggar Christ, which manifests itself not only in terms of material charity, but in terms of a holy sadness and pity manifest in the rich toward the poor, much like Christ manifests pity towards us. This is the deeper meaning of the dirge Gregory raises in the midst of the liturgical celebration. It's not guilt, but the heart of Christ which they share. And again, you know, you could talk about this over and over again in the history of the church. Why, for example, these tokotrophion, these basilias, they're forerunners of what we call hospitals. There were more hospitals per capita in 5th century Egypt than any other time in the history of the world until the Industrial Revolution. Why? Right. But that's another topic. And so the moment of music, to get back to my main point, the moment of music can change our experience, right? For good or for ill. This explains, I think, St. Augustine's ambivalence about singing in the church, vacillating as he did between what he called the danger of sensuality and the undeniable benefits of music. Our minds by singing can either be, as he said, more ardently inflamed to piety or merely languish in sensuous gratification. I think you see that in Christian music even today, this division. These are the two possibilities of music for St. Augustine, right? They could either ardently inflame piety or languish in sensuous gratification. A neoliberal economist reading Milton Friedman and listening to Joe Walsh's song Life's Been Good, you know, the one that goes, I have a mansion, forget the price, I have accountants pay for it all. That person is likely to see the beggar on the street corner differently than the person just come from the Methodist chapel singing the lyrics of Charles Wesley's hymn, Help Us Make the Poor Our Friends. I suggest to you, those are two different people with two different views of the world. Culture and art make a difference. Milton Friedman and Joel Walsh offer you a different experience of the world than does the Bible and Methodists. Such is the difference good music can make in the parish and in a city. It enables us to see the other differently, even experience the other person differently. it changes things. It facilitates what we understand in Christian theology. It facilitates the sacramental. As when, for example, Winnie the Pooh, he sang a song once for Piglet. You should go and read it. You should read Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh sang a song once of Piglet's bravery. And Piglet asked him after the song was over, he said, did I really do that? And Pooh answered, well, in poetry, in a piece of poetry, well, you did it. Because the poetry says you did it. And that's how people know. Which, if you know the rest of the story, it inspired him to do the noble thing, which is give up his house for Al at the end of the House of Pooh Corner. But this is to talk theology. So moving on to the next, the last section. Phenomenologists, of course, have treated the sacramental, the concept of the sacramental, extensively, and I would suggest brilliantly. I think here of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, for example, who is a deeply Catholic view of the sacramental. Nonetheless, due to my own sort of limited capacity and time, and keeping in mind the purpose of this talk, I want to take a theological turn, a parochial turn, and offer a different way of thinking about the moment of music. I've so far described only phenomenologically, with the help of Bob Wood. So thinking theologically now about the moment of music, that will bring us, I think, to a point of clarity about the initial questions I put about the place of music in the parish, in the city, about the point and difference of such music, and about its contribution to whatever you want to call the common good. And so I want to propose here a theological way of thinking about the phenomenology of the moment of music, the moment of sensing, interpreting, and presence to being. And I think it's a very easy thing to do. Because there is at hand a really traditional theological model called the Munus triplex of Christ. It's at the very bottom of the handout. And that's the threefold office of Christ, the prophet, priest, and king, which theologians have used for centuries as a model for understanding the work of Christ, not only historically and biblically, but also in the church among the faithful. It's a way of thinking about the work of Christ in the ministry of the Christians and the church, and that goes back to the fathers of the church, to Eusebius and Chrysostom and Jerome and St. Augustine. As Chrysostom said, at your baptism you were made king, priest, and prophet. Easter Vigil, I baptized and confirmed a ton of people, and I chrismated them, right? I put the chrism on their foreheads, which is the same sweet-smelling stuff that we used to put on emperors and kings. You know. Since the Reformation, though, it's been more immediately associated with Protestant theology. John Calvin, for example, classified the mission of Christ in this way. These three offices, he called them, were the only offices in the New Testament which involved anointing. He was using it for polemical reasons, because he was emphasizing those offices in Christ against the teaching and the sacramental and political authority of the Roman Church. Halfway rightly, I think. Nonetheless, Catholics have never abandoned this way of thinking about the work of Christ. John Henry Newman, for example, in the sermons before and after his conversion to Catholicism, describe the threefold office in terms of Christ's teaching, his death on the cross, and his resurrection. Offices given to the apostles to suffer, to teach, and to rule. Very interesting, suffer, to teach, and to rule. And their offices, which would begin to every Christian in the universal obligation to learn the truth, to witness to the truth, and to suffer the truth. I like that. That's how Newman put it, the Christian is obliged to learn the truth, to witness to the truth, and to suffer the truth. Suffer for the truth. In the 20th century, this has been revived by people like Yves Congar, a great Dominican theologian who used it as a way to renew an understanding of what lay people do in the church. The priesthood of the laity is described in terms of being ordered to God, of offering up the life of one's life itself, like the martyrs did. The kingship of the laity is described as Christian freedom in relation to the world, that is the power and the ability to actually do good, no matter what Twitter says. And the prophetic is the office of the laity, speaking in what he called the second voice, that is the echo of the apostolic voice, that is the magisterium should speak dogmatically, and the laity should speak prophetically in the world. It should be a 1-2 punch. This is all in theory, obviously, because we're too busy screwing things up with sexual abuse. And this is how the church operates, again, in theory, in the world. Even today, doctrines of Vatican II and the Catechism of the Catholic Church describe not only the mission of Christ, but also the ministry of Christians, both lay and ordained, in terms of the munis triplex, and in terms of the prophet, priest, and king. And so how does this theological model help us understand the moment of music, which we have hitherto only described in light of Robert Wood? And as I said, I don't think this is difficult. If the moment of music is an experience of sensing, interpreting, and presence to being, then might it also be an experience of the prophetical, the priestly, and the kingly work of Christ? The munis triplex is a theological model, but it doesn't describe a division of labor between either the persons of the Trinity or the members of the Church, nor even does it describe distinct functions within particular ministries. But it describes a unity of operations within the work of Christ himself as he is present in the Church in various ways. For example, the ministry of the priest, a person like me, that I have distinct moments of teaching, sanctifying, and ruling, say like in a Bible study or at Mass or running a parish and signing checks, as I do. Yet each distinct activity has all three offices at work nonetheless. So too in the music, in the moment of music, again, thinking of the very moment, the aural experience of music, all three offices of Christ are simultaneously at play. In singing of friendship with Christ's poor, for example, as Charles Wesley did, in the moment of singing, we see and we hear and we interpret the poor as our friends, and we even become friends with the poor, living in material charity with them, in communion, as it is described in the Bible, on earth as it is in heaven. Like the prophets and priests, we identify the poor, we see them, and we revere and love the poor, and as kings, we act freely on that reverence and love in works of charity, right? We actually act, we treat them like our friends. So seeing the moment of music phenomenologically first, and then in terms of the threefold office of Christ, we begin to see, at least I begin to see, the sacramentality of such a moment. And when I mean sacramentality the way Christians understand it, you come to my church, there's going to be a bunch of people who believe that at one moment it's bread, at another moment it's not, right? Because of something I say. That's sacramentality, something changes. We can begin to see how in song we can actually begin to see the poor as friends. In the moment of music, we can actually begin to see the poor as our friends and also live like it. Experiencing a sacramental change of sorts, the beggar turns into a friend, right? And we can see that the moment of music is also Christ's work. It's prophetic, it's priestly, it's kingly, right? It speaks, it reaches out in communion, and then it acts. And so the moment of music is a moment in which I would suggest Christ himself speaks naming the poor as his own and drawing us toward him now present in the poor. So again, this is a deeply Methodist thing as well. So in the moment of music in the parish, Christ speaks in the world. He speaks of environment, the environment, which is a bastardized word, in my opinion, talked of Wendell Berry. Speaks of the environment as creation. Speaks of the poor as friends. And it speaks of the enemy as forgiven. Right? And this speaking changes things, not only substances, but people. And that's what music in the parish, in the city, can do. It can be the voice of Jesus. But of course, only if the music is good, which is another discussion entirely. And there's a lot of bad music out. So finally, seeing music in the parish and the city in this way, phenomenologically and theologically, as the speech of Christ, I think it frees us from that sort of cultural snobbishness, which is merely a rehearsal of the pretensions of godless modernity. At the beginning of my talk, I made reference to Terry Eagleton's argument that in and after the Enlightenment, fine art and high culture came to be seen by some as a way to mythologize reason and replace religion. In the aftermath of the collapse of religion, he said, scientific rationalism took over, quote, the doctrinal certainties. Politics took over, quote, the mission to transform the face of the earth. And culture took over the stewardship of, quote, unquote, spiritual death. It's a project, Eagleton argues, I think rightly, it failed. And the point he makes is the point I want to conclude with. Eagleton, if you want a good assessment or description of Christianity as something intellectually respectable, most of the people who criticize Christianity, their biggest problem is that they've only read crap, right? Read Terry Eagleton. I dare you. Anyway, he says repeatedly that Christianity is, quote, a faith which turns on an executed body. Christianity, we should remember, quote, is not about moral uplift. It's not about political unity or aesthetic charm. Christianity, quote, has little or nothing to say of responsible citizenship. It shows no enthusiasm for social consensus, standards of civic excellence, or codes of good conduct, he says. He adds, what it adds, what Christianity adds to common or garden morality is not some supernatural support, but the grossly inconvenient news that our forms of life must undergo radical dissolution if they are to be born as just and compassionate communities. The sign of that dissolution is a solidarity with the poor and the powerless. It is here that a new configuration of faith, culture, and politics might be reborn. So the point is this. Music in the parish, in the city, is not immediately about cultural preservation or anything you would want to call civilization. It's not about keeping the heritable beauty of civilization safe from the barbarian masses who watch The Voice. That's just a side effect of our singing. If you can somehow pull yourself away from crap and see beautiful things, that's good for you. But that's not the primary, that's just a side effect. And in this sense, Kierkegaard was right. The aesthetic doesn't need to be abolished, just needs, as he said, it needs to be dethroned. Music in the parish in the city is about speaking Christ in the city. And that's a disturbing voice. That's a very radical voice. And it's a voice that tears down as much as it builds up. And it's a voice which people on the right and people on the left continually bastardized. Continually. Right? We are not cultural curators. We're Christians. Right? At least me, I don't know about you. And Christians should never forget that, ever. Even when they're singing. That's all I've got. Thank you very much for putting up with me.
Reverend, for speaking to us tonight. I just want to mention, Robert Woods spoke to this group in 2011 on neuropsychology.
Oh, yeah.
And as I recall, we tried to get him back, but maybe he's semi-retired now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. You said there's bad music out there.
Right.
And I would offer a different perspective from that.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a movie a while back. It was set in the Congo. These people were very, very poor. They were dealing with this horrific civil war. And so these musicians were playing their music. And I saw that it's not music that I would listen to,
mm-hmm.
but this music provided these people joy, maybe an escape. It also seemed to ground them in their culture and provided them cohesiveness. And so I would argue that it springs out of one's culture. And so to say that, well, there's bad music and there's good music, I think that, respectfully to you, sir, I think that misses the point. So I was wondering if you can comment on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, as you said, I mean, culture, music is a any like any sort of art. It's a cultural product, right? And so the criterion by which you would judge it good or bad is provided by that culture, right? And so, as a Western Christian, and that's me, I would have no way to judge between good Congolese music and bad Congolese music. I just wouldn't. If I were Congolese, however, I might, right? And so, in the context in which I talk about good music and bad music as a Western Christian in the Western Christian tradition. I think there is an argument to be made, right? So, if you were to take, and I'm just talking about Christian music, right? So, secular music, I think if you think Keith Urban is better than Willie Nelson, you're an idiot, right? But the foundation upon which I make that judgment is not very. I mean, it's not important. But when it comes to liturgical music, right, there is Christian music. Christian liturgical music is theological, right? That is, it is praise of God, right? If the greatest hymn is the Gloria, which it's so great, it's stuck in the Mass, right? And it is nothing but praise of the Trinitarian God, right? And I would say that's good Christian music, because it is oriented toward Theos, it's oriented toward God. Bad Christian music, and again, it's a judgment, is therapeutic, in the sense that the orientation is more self, right? And people have written on this, and it's one of those things where you will always have argument about this, but I think Christian music that tends toward that tends to be self-oriented rather than God-oriented, that is at least the first criteria I would point to talk about good versus bad. But that's a cultural thing, right? And so my friend Ekram up at the East Plano Islamic Center. I go to Friday prayers with him. I don't know. It's all Arabic to me. I mean, yes, sir.
I don't think you used the term, but I think if I understood you properly, you were essentially making the argument that good music constitutes a form of what phenomenologists tend to call intersubjectivity. I'm very sympathetic with the concept of intersubjectivity. Mm-hmm. The problem I've always had with it is that it seems to conflate subjectivity with objectivity, and say one subjectivity with somebody else's subjectivity. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that, because that's just a broad issue that I've always had phenomenology.
Yeah, no, I really can't say anything other than that I get that and I agree with that, right? And so, you know, within the context of Christian theology, you know, intersubjectivity would be described in terms of the communio sanctorum, you know, the communion of saints and the sharing of goods. Those lines do definitely get blurred. Thinking of particularly, you know, Augustine's, the very last book of the City of God, for example, where his description of heaven, I mean, that's probably the most extreme case of Christian intersubjectivity there is. And reading it doesn't make one entirely comfortable, right? Because the distinction between subject and object are paper thin, right? And you see it later in later spiritualities, where it becomes almost a Buddhist annihilation of the self. But I accept that's something you would want to say yes, but on that. I mean, that's about as good I got on that. Go.
You talked about the difference between sacred music that focuses on the transcendent and focuses on the selfish. But it seems to me there's a third category that would focus on the creation, or maybe the brotherhood of man, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, morning is broken, this is my father's world, you know, mm-hmm. Ode to Joy, maybe. Mm-hmm. And if you accept those three characteristics, you seem to elevate the transcendent as sort of more relating to this idea of the poor, but I would relate the creation category, the one that focuses on the created order, not the transcendent order, to me relates more to the social justice concept. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, kind of, I guess the, if you were you can't understand, you can't understand your backyard as creation without a creator, right? And so, the transcendent oriented, to use that way of saying, you can't separate it from the creation level of things, right? For lack of I can't think of a better way to say it. Not without being, if you cut them off, then you have to talk about pantheism of some sort, right? And so for me, creation is, as Paul would say in Romans 1, and as Thomas Aquinas would say in the first 13 questions of the Summa, the only way to understand creation as creation is in light of what we know about God, right? And again, that's a particular Christian claim of things. I mean, Augustine talks about that in his commentaries on Genesis. What we know of God, what we reveal of God, reflects back onto the phenomenal, right? And therefore, it becomes creation. And so, when you sing "Morning is Broken," or when you sing about the beauty of creation, or as St. Francis, most famous, that did Brother Moon, Sister Sun, or whatever. St. Francis would have only done that had he believed in Jesus. Right? Great book to read on that, actually, describes it better than I did, is G.K. Chesterton's biography of St. Francis of Assisi, which is a brilliant text. It's a wonderful description of how he saw creation as pure reflection of the deity. Yeah. Good stuff.
I think early on you defined art as the hearing of the human heart. If that is the case, why is there so much technically good art that's actually horrible art? If you would agree that that statement's true.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Technically proficient.
Yeah, good. I mean, technically proficient art, that is bad, right? I think to speak specifically about your first description is, art is art articulates the desire that the heart has facing the presence to be, right? So art is basically sort of a narratival instantiation of that experience that we have when we stand and look at something and we feel finite, right? Good art versus bad art under those circumstances would be, let's look at this wonderful mural behind us, right? Does that mural, there's some technical stuff that's not the greatest, but does that mural articulate the heart's desire for the whole, right? Or does it want you, does it make you want to order the special? Does that make sense? And so, for lack of a better way to articulate that, I think that's the judgment. One of my favorite artists, for example, is a woman by the name of Kathy Kollwitz. It's her lithographs are just profound, right? And so, and especially her monument to her son called The Parents. I can't look at a single lithograph by Kathy Kollwitz and not have that experience. But I look at other things, take like a Thomas Kinkade painting. I don't have that experience, right? And Thomas Kinkade, they're lovely things, pretty, or Warner Solomon, Jesus, right? I have a particular historical reference to the Warner Solomon Jesus. So for me, it's a different, I wouldn't call it an artistic experience. I've got to be careful about that because one of the descendants of Warner Solomon's a Christian.
Thank you. Very interesting talk. Music has got so many dimensions to it. It's a fascinating subject, the psychological, sociological, even the mathematical and metaphysical aspects of it. But I want to kind of go off on a different thing. In this quote from St. Gregory, it says that sometimes anguish is of more value than pleasure, sadness than celebration, meritorious tears than unseeking laughter. It seems like the Catholics especially have elevated suffering to nobility and so forth. And most of us nowadays see suffering as something to be avoided. Let's give them opiates, let's put them in a coma, let's euthanasia or whatever. But I've never quite understood, it seems like it's making a virtue out of necessity to say that suffering is, it's an imitation of Christ, but what is perceived value in that is peculiar to me.
Okay, that's a good question. Gregor was saying in that particular line, he was really dealing with a Catholic concept of suffering. But the Catholic concept of suffering, the theology of suffering, is first, I guess sort of the first sort of sentence of a Catholic theology of suffering, as best as I can describe it, is that in this contingent world, suffering is, right? And so it just is, And suffering is just there. And so therefore, what is the answer to suffering? Is the answer to suffering the elimination of it, the avoidance of it, or the reckoning of it? Right? The gospel, the Bible as a whole, but the gospels particularly, do not say anything other than Christ embraced suffering and took it upon himself, that God took upon himself suffering in his son Jesus. And so therefore, suffering now has a sacramental quality to it. You do have the ability to unite yourself to the passion of Christ, right? And so it can become, to use the term, meritorious. To describe it in terms of a noble virtue or something as somehow that suffering is a good to be pursued and achieved and valorized, that's not the Catholic position. I mean, that's a Googled description, but that's not the Catholic position. The Church would say regarding euthanasia and the mitigation of suffering, euthanasia is direct killing of an innocent person. So the Church would say that's intrinsically evil, because who the hell decides that one? But as far as the elimination of pain and suffering, that's a proportionate prudential decision one makes, right? But to say that, you know, a person should not be given proper hospice care or proper pain relief, that's not the Catholic position. The details over a specific specific issues might be different than yours. But to characterize the Catholic position as somehow thumbs up for suffering, that's not
right. Many saints though have good for long suffering.
Oh, you betcha. Yeah. So were some children in Sri Lanka this Sunday.
Father, before we get drowned out by the sound, and yes, we're going to have to leave here.
Oh, really?
I want to get back. I want to get back to music as ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Every culture that we know of in the present and the past has used music of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Humans are the only animal that use music in a harmonious, melodious way. In every type of ritual, not necessarily religious ritual, it can be government, military, sacrificial, all kinds of, you know, music is used as a ritual, in a ritual. And rituals are so important in religion as a sensory experience. Incense, candles, chanting. Can you comment on the importance of ritual, music as ritual?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
The best person to read on ritual, as far as I'm concerned, is a man by the name of Victor Turner. And he was really one of the forerunners in quote-unquote ritual studies. One of the reasons the Catholic Church's ritual in the last 60 years has taken such a nosedive toward the banal is because Vatican II happened about 10 years before ritual studies sort of emerged as a discipline. And if you read Victor Turner, who, you know, without qualm said that Vatican II was a disaster as far as ritual is concerned, and I tend to agree with him. What does ritual do, right? Aesthetic or musical? And that is, you know, Victor Turner studied African tribes, right? And he looked at the ritual of African tribes. And he comes away after studying for 30 years and he says, look, cultures that have really, really complex rituals, right? rituals within rituals, wheels within wheels of ritual life, right? That no one could possibly, no one single person could possibly sort of map out. Those cultures, he said, are healthy cultures, alive cultures. The cultures in which ritual has been flattened or reduced to mere one or two things, like Thanksgiving and Black Friday and Super Bowl Sunday, those cultures are dead or dying, right? And so that's his view that he took, and he comes back to England when Vatican II happens, where they strip away so much of the ritual culture of Catholicism, right? And the Protestants followed suit. Everything, and now you go into a Catholic church, there's only about five things you need to understand anyway, and we do our damnedest to make sure that you understand them, right? Whereas before Vatican II, your senses are getting blown away by a thousand different things, right? Salt on the tongue, incense, candles, statues in every corner, it's ridiculous. But what's going on there, right? Every single ritual, every single minor ritual or fragment of ritual points to a part of the narrative, right? And so, take for example incense, right? Incense, a bad liturgist will tell you, an incense was invented, it brought into the church because, people stunk, they didn't have deodorant, and which might be a side effect, but incense signifies prayer. Incense signifies the prayer of the saints from Revelation chapter 4. And that's just one instance of every single, like the good Easter Vigil, right? We chant, we bring in a paschal candle from a fire, and we sing Lumen Christi as we break the darkness with light, and the light spreads. Anybody who's read the Bible for 5 minutes can get the references, right? But there's more subtle references. Like before baptism, I take the paschal candle, I dip it 3 times in the baptismal font, right? That's a little bit more deep, right? But all of that's going on within, around and with and upon people who may or may not have read the Bible, but it's an immersion in the narrative, right? At a ritual level. And the more complex and the more robust that is, the better we are. And that's what Victor Turner says. And so that's true of music, it's true of incense. One of the biggest problems that churches have done is that they stripped their ritual down to the bare minimum. They made their buildings very, very ugly. And their preaching is horrible. And so when you go into a Catholic church, you are unimpressed 9 times out of 10. And then, by the way, we've got this constant drumbeat narrative of sexual abuse. Who the hell would want to do that, right? Which is why the best sell I can make for Catholicism is look into it more deeply. I dare you, right? As John Henry Newman said, whoever is immersed in history ceases to be a Protestant. And that's how I became a Catholic in spite of Catholics.
Ceased to be a Catholic. Right.
So I mean, because Catholics drive me up the wall.
Thank you.
Thank you.